Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to Focus on Albany. I'm Cynthia Poore, and I have a new guest host with me, my friend Russell Ziemba. Russell is going to conduct this interview, and he's going to be talking to his friend John Wolcott. So, Russell, here's the floor.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's my pleasure to be a host here. I will be talking with John Wolcott. He's an Albany native, historian, and preservationist. I'd like to say that this story is one that hasn't been covered in depth and or from this perspective in the Times Union or any other venue. So I'm pleased to talk with you, John, and I hope our listeners will be informed and enjoy the show. John?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Well, that was a lengthy introduction of you, but why don't you tell the listeners about the Church of the Holy Innocents on North Pearl?
Well, it's a complicated story, and it's hard in a nutshell. I'll try to just run through some of the main main highlights and mainly get to what's being left out of the news.
Let me just inform the listeners just a little bit of background information about the church. It's the Church of the Holy Innocents on North Pearl and Colony Streets in Albany. It's right near the Broadway Viaduct where the railroad trains go over Broadway. The church was built back in 1848?
Yes.
Is that true, John? Yeah, okay.
Yes.
And
I wasn't there, but from everything I read, that's when it was built.
Yeah, well, it has some unique features and qualities of any church in the country, and there are some qualities it shares with one other church that's also at risk. It's got very interesting stained glass windows, and its history is quite interesting as well. Just going by it and looking at it, it's a place that's very appealing. The street, Colony Street, which is on the corner of, is a street that I drove down a few weeks ago, and I really enjoyed it. I took it very slowly because the street's uneven, but it's a Belgian block street with all of the buildings that date probably from the 1800s, and at the very bottom is the Broadway Viaduct, and you take a right-hand turn and finally get onto Broadway, but it's it felt like going down a street 130 years ago. It has a quality that is rare to find these days. What do you think, John?
That's a good just gut description of it, but somebody going there for the first time. Also, you might think, try to figure out, what kind of church is it? Because there's a Russian onion dome bell turret where there used to be. Yeah, there used to be an open bell coat there, which is an English term for just a stone extension of the gable. With a bell hung out in the open, but this was sold to a Russian Orthodox congregation in 1956, and they were anxious over anxious to identify themselves, so they took this beautiful stone bell coat off. I wish they had done something with engineers and architects to move it a little back from there, and they could have hit both. But
the Onion Dome is very identifiable, and you can easily find the church from a distance, use it as a landmark because of that.
Even now, that's true. Anyway, this goes back to what's called the main background to this. Started in England, in architectural societies that started forming up around 1839, 1840, centered in Camden and Cambridge, also Exeter Cathedral, had a parallel movement. It may have been preceded that, but then they all merged into ecclesiological societies. And there's an ecclesiological society that formed up in New York City, too, for the American component of it. And what they were, they had like a doctrinaire campaign to promote Gothic style over and above any other style, saying that it was the correct ecclesiastical style. That's what they call an ecclesiologist. And it had a kind of doctrinaire bent in that all the designs had the showed where the altar would be in mm-hmm. the structural chancel. But that was nothing new to them, the structural chancel. But the position of the altar, sent lengthwise across the wall, was somewhat doctrinaire, because a lot of churches of England had a position differently before that. But that's a little bit unnecessary to go into at this point. And they always centered a cross in back of the center of the altar, which caused concern. All these things seem ridiculous to anybody, any denomination today. But back then, a lot of people were all wrought up in it, they were ignorant to do so, but they, what's that term? Ignorant and indifferent. They weren't indifferent. They were very passionate about everything. So this caused a lot of controversy all through the 19th century as the movement grew. And it did some good. It opened up churches, even with a lot of acrimony for a long time, just to look better. And also, it gave freedom to a lot of other churches. It probably affected a wide range of churches that had nothing to do with the Roman Catholic or Anglican denominations. And you see today, even in Baptist churches, you'll see altars with crosses and candles on them. Oh, candles caused an uproar once they started putting those on. And
it caused an uproar today because of the possibility of fire.
That's a valid concern, sure. Sure. The one architect that spearheaded this in the United States and Canada both was Frank Wills. And he was brought over by the new bishop of Fredericton in New Brunswick in 1845 to design a new cathedral there. And it was taking so long because it was such an elaborate design that he built a chapel of ease, which is called St. Anne's Chapel, which you can see to this very day. And while the auspices of Bishop Medley, that's on the further northernmost navigable from the ocean up the St. John's River in New Brunswick, right by the frontier with Maine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not too hard to visit. It's worth a visit because this chapel of St. Anne's is unbelievably beautiful. And if you look at it, it seems to be the prototype, partially the prototype, for Holy Innocents in Albany, which is very interesting because the chancel arch has the the 23rd Psalm along it, which has been destroyed in this one in Albany, by the way, never reported.
Will you explain to everyone what a chancel arch is? Will you explain?
Not champ. You say champ? No, chancel is the word.
Right. Yeah. Please explain what that is.
Oh, well that's the part where the Holy Communion takes place in a church. And it's usually an architectural chancel. It's a little bit lower and a little bit narrower than the nave, which is the body of the church.
Mm-hmm.
That's overly simplistic, I suppose.
Well, thank you.
Some chancels have choirs, and they have choir screens. Well, the one in Fredericton has a choir screen, which the one in Albany never had. Probably wasn't room for it. But it had the 23rd Psalm along the edge of the chancel arch. The chancel arch is pointed too, you know, the Gothic shape. They don't have to be. You can do it in any style and have that. Which is why I kind of, in retrospect, look askance at this overemphasis on the Gothic style, as though that was the one and only thing, and it did a lot of damage by neglecting other styles. And also
now, John,
doing damage, especially in England. So, you
were telling me earlier. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. And another thing that's peculiar to just St. Ian's Chapel in Fredericton and Holy Innocents Church in Albany is something that was just rediscovered recently, as it's been covered with paint, was the entire text of the Ambrosian hymn, Te Deum Laudamus. The title's a line, but the text is English. Don't worry about that. And his paint started peeling off in the middle of this last winter because of the neglect. They never did anything to winterize it.
Yeah.
And that's another thing not reported in the press. It's getting worse. How much
Who
worse,
are the
I don't
owners?
Know. I've only been
Who
inside by proxy, and that's what these pictures are from. Are my proxy views. That's all I will say about that at this point. I'm sorry, what were you saying?
Who is the owner?
Who owns it right now? Oh.
Yeah.
Well, it's the entity that's been letting it go to waste since 1997. How many years is that? It's called Demolition from Neglect.
Yeah, 19 years.
And I'm posing that the neglect has been deliberate. And that's Hope House Drug Rehab, which, sad to say, is one of the several operations in Albany operated by Bishop Emeritus Howard Hubbard, who's known for doing a lot of good work. He's a financial whiz. He runs all the financial operations for this and several other operations, like several of them, and they're all good charitable causes. And it's called HH Foundation, I think, HH Financial. That's Howard Hubbard Financial Corporation. And it's a good cause, you know, for drug rehab. But they shouldn't have neglected. There was no reason for them not to use some of the money to, you know, over the years, keep up repair. It wouldn't have come to the $2 million cost that's posed for it now. See, they have an exclusive ad out through LoopNet ads. People should try to get that on their computer or they can and they'll see it, because this is not generally known to the public. You see, it was in the paper that three entities got together after there was a cave-in in the church last May 2nd. And the three entities are Albany Historic Albany Foundation, Mayor Sheehan's office, and it kind of reads as though it's just her office and not the city as such, but I don't buy that either, and Hope House itself. And they're working together to find someone that will buy this property for a dollar. Fine. But a catch to it is they have to show that they can raise $2 million for restoration. Now, people should be asking the question of why that much, because all the press said in their spoon-fed news release from the mayor's office was that the lower southeast corner caved in. That's not true. The entire chancel arch caved in that day. And there's no excuse for that. That shows serious neglect over the years. And I don't think they should be left off the hook for that. And they are being left off the hook. And even though I'm reluctant to criticize Historic Albany, Sue Holland was on TV less than a week after that saying $2 million isn't much money. I could raise that myself because I know how to do it. I have lots of experience. But then she never said that again. And you can find that probably on the Internet if you probe around and put in unanswered questions swirl around Arbor Hill Church. Anyway, it's in a whole lot of stuff that I sent you. I guess you haven't had time to open it up yet.
Some of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So she should be put on the spot to do that. But there's a really tricky relationship going on between Hope House, the mayor's office, and Historic Albany. And they all seem to have agreed not to tell anybody that the chancel arch caved in and not just the lower southeast corner.
Mm.
I find that offensive.
Mm.
It's things being kept from the public. I never trust that. The public doesn't know that. And all anyone has to do is walk down where you walked to on these granite paving blocks. And you get to looking at where the nave joins the chancel. This is a structural chancel, so the roof line is a few feet lower than the roof line of the nave, which will be to your right. The chancel will be to your left, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the top of the arch used to be there. If you look there now, you got to line it up exactly. What do you see on the other side? Sky. There is no chancel arch. There's been no chancel arch since May 2nd last year. That's inexcusable.
Over a year.
Over a year. And they haven't kept up the repairs. And the lettering of
the
Te Deum was exposed because of the weathering. That was a good thing. But to my knowledge, nobody's trying to look at the rest of it. But the most spectacular thing that the public does not know about, and this is spectacular, is the chancel ceiling. It was considered to represent the vault of heaven because of Holy Communion taking place underneath it. That's how much emphasis was put in that by the ecclesiologist and then what was called the Oxford Movement, which kind of evolved from that. And it's unbelievably beautiful. And I sent you images of that. But if people want to see the full range of these beautiful interior features, all being subject to damage to an unknown extent now, all they have to do is contact my email. You're ready to write this down. It's Beverweich, and that's Beverweich1 at gmail.com. And I will furnish these images for people to look at themselves. And that's one way to overcome the public being kept ignorant on this.
Well,
I know that's a situation where the public is not being informed. And that's what's happening here. and it's been happening here for some time. I know people in the neighborhood, right? It's all mostly all minority people, and some of them were very concerned about this from the get-go. They wanted to see something go in there that would benefit their neighborhood. And I came up with this idea, and a lot of people liked it. I talked to just person to person. To have some kind of thing that would relate to the dedication of the church, Holy Innocence, and have it like pre-K and nursery care for children, and keep the names up to symbolize the need to care for children all over the world all the time.
There are hundreds of children that live right across the street
from need for
that.
All the time. What?
There are hundreds of children that live right across the street from there. There's a housing complex.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it was
right
some
there.
People. Oh, it was some people. Some of the people that are very responsible-minded people and leadership in there that talked to me about that. But I could never get anything going in the local media, which is too bad. And
well, that's an area of the
you
city
that
you could
change that, which is good.
That's an area of the city that is really increased in popularity, and I hear there's a big development plan for that area, very near the church, the Holy Innocence Church, that relates to it. And why don't you say a bit about that?
Well, that's true, and that could go two ways. It's called the Warehouse District, up where Nipper is. Nipper is a big warehouse, and there's that warehouse by the railroad bridge too. I don't know if that's part of it or not. Anyway, it's going to be converted into a combination of apartments, offices, then retail stores in the bottom. There's other buildings around there that are going to change into that, and there's lots of big time money being put into it. There was a whole article in the paper about it a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
Now that there are people there who are going to have children that would benefit by it. Also, they would probably donate money to it. On the other hand, if some claim is made that the church is too far gone and have to tear it down, then a whole lot of money can be made on selling the airspace for something to go along with the warehouse district. So I could see it going one way or the other. What?
Yeah, that's a big worry.
Yeah,
that's
it is.
That's a big worry. That's why
it's more of a
worry.
It is all this information being kept from people. Yeah.
You know,
that's right.
John, I hate to say bad things about Howard Hubbard because he's done good things, but he was a poor steward of the churches that the Catholic Church owned. Within the last 10 years, 33 in the Capital District were sold to other people, some to congregations. One was demolished in Waterfleet, St. Patrick's.
Well, the ones
Church,
that were sold to inner city congregations, that was done well because they're being taken care of. St. Patrick's is another story, though.
Yeah. Well, to become a price chopper is really wrong.
Oh yeah.
In fact, we called it Christ chopper for a while.
Oh yes, I remember that.
Yeah.
That was a very bad show, any which way you cut and slice it.
You know what that reminded me of, John, is when the Buddhist temple or the carvings were desecrated in Afghanistan by extremists.
Oh, yes.
When the temples in the Warsaw Ghetto, the most fabulous temples in Poland, were exploded and demolished by the Nazis, you know, it's the same scale. It's unthinkable that we would do that in our own country at this time. That something so important to so many people that put money in it, just a few years before that, they replaced the roof. They raised hundreds of thousands of dollars to replace the roof on the promise that they would keep their church, and it didn't happen. So I hate to see that happening. There have been some good reuses of churches, and fine.
Yeah.
But you've got to. You got to take care of what you own. And, the Catholic Church is not a fly-by-night organization. They should, these churches are very important. They're important to our communities. They've got important histories. They're magnificent buildings, irreplaceable. You can't build that type of building anymore these days for, you know, for less than a fortune. Or it may not be possible, but maybe the craftsmanship or the materials may not be available. John, will you talk about some of the unique physical features of the church, like the stained glass windows, because they're wonderful windows.
Yes. The stained glass windows are the main historic treasure there, I think. Because the Bolton brothers. Now, a little before Frank Wills came to Canada and the United States, these Bolton brothers moved from England, and they and their family was kind of wealthy. And they built a home in Westchester County, which at that time was not all wealthy people, except some of the landholders, like themselves, came to be. They were all farmers. All the people, the regular people there, were farmers and fisher folk, because so much of it is bordered on Long Island Sound and the Harlem River. And the Bolton family, did an awful lot to help poor, ordinary people. They founded schools, and they founded this church, which they designed themselves. The whole family was so artistic. They were very artistic. And they designed this little church called Christ Church in Pelham, which you can see to this very day. And these two Bolton brothers, John and William, taught themselves, so it's written, to make figurative stained glass, which was never done by anybody in North America before, or in the U.S. at least, where the accounts read. They were first ones. There were a lot of, geometric glass in churches, geometric simple designs, but not with figures. Now, people with curved folds of clothes and so forth.
I think people are more appealing. People are more appealing, and you can identify with people rather than geometry.
These people were not ecclesiologists at all. They had little to do with the Oxford movement, except when they got contracts for some churches sometimes. They were evangelicals, but they believed in expressing the basics of the Bible with imagery. They really did.
Yeah.
And they produced the first stained glass and the east window of the church, and that's important because that's over east window means over the altar, regardless of what the actual direction is. It's an ecclesiastical term, east, north, west, so forth. That's important to remember. Get mixed up sometimes. And it was the image of the gift of the Magi, one of my favorite themes.
Yeah,
and
that's a good one.
It's beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful windows ever made. I mean, it was way before Tiffany or others, but it's still it's beautiful in its own category. And there wasn't any structural chancel there, but there was the arrangement of it with the communion rail and everything. But it was in the old way, not the Oxford movement way, which is really interesting. And so the next job they got was over in Brooklyn for Holy Trinity, which was just being built. And that wasn't part of the ecclesiological movement either. And what they wanted there was a full range, comprehensive, all-in-one program of the history of the Bible from the beginning of time to beyond the end of time. It's like a cosmic mind blast to see it. I've seen it. I've been looking up to get in here to see it. And it's unbelievable. And it had nothing to do with any of this other. And it's being restored now by Wade Associates of Albany.
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
it's been open all the time, but there's been, you know, repair. You can't go up in the balcony and look close up. And it's got clear story windows. And it's got ground level windows and so forth. And it's unbelievable. It's just so unbelievable. And the masterpiece of it was the one of Angels and Musicians with Marilyn Jubal on the bottom and Jubal holding the tambourine and dancing. And then it goes up to the way up to the top with Angels in Heaven. And the Metropolitan Museum has had it for many years. And they're giving it back. And that's going to increase the value of the ones in Albany, which worries me because of the way people are going to start calculating.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Judge, we have only a couple of minutes left, but I want you to answer one question.
We can have you back again.
Yes. You said that there's a link between Mayor Sheehan, Bishop Hubbard, and what was the other entity?
The Historic Albany Foundation. They're all working together.
Okay,
and they're not telling, none of them are telling the public that the chancel arch has caved in. They're also not telling the public that there have been two sets, a list of people that were put out and applied to Hope House the first time on their own, and they were all turned down. And I'm told, I believe in information, that some of these were perfectly worthy entities to take over that church. And there's a new list, too, and nobody's being shown the list. I was showed it really quickly, and then they said, oh, you can't read this, and they put it in the desk. And that's wrong, too. There's too many things that the public does not know and should know, in my opinion.
Okay, my question to you is, you're bringing this out so people will know right now. What can people do to have the mayor, the bishop, and the Historic Albany Foundation come public with this information?
Should they contact them? Yes, contact them.
Okay.
I don't have the mayor's number right now, Historic Albany, but they're all in the book. Hope House is probably in the book, too. Well, and this is just my opinion, is that that I think that all together they should be able to come up with the money themselves to pay for the stabilization so it doesn't get any worse, and then be upfront about how much the cost is. Hope House was responsible for this through neglect. There's no two ways about it. I don't know what they'll do to weasel out of it. But there's reasons like that why I call Albany Weaselwick instead of Beverwick sometimes.
You know, time's almost up, John. I'll publish this radio show, and then can you come on again to talk further about this?
Yes, because what I did was kind of oversimplified, and I can get more specific about a whole series of things that are not known about the beautiful art treasures inside, which I can show very good pictures of, most of which were I have by proxy. That's all I feel free to say about that. But they're beautiful images, and people will enjoy seeing them. And hopefully they'll ask, why aren't these being preserved together? Because there's a danger of them being all split apart for different purposes. And to me, that's not art preservation or historic preservation.
Mm-hmm. Then we'll figure out a way to make the public see it. So you will be on again at some point, right, John?
Yes.
Okay. You've been listening to John Wolcott, who is a Albany historian and
preservationist. He's an Albany native. He's been here his whole life, although he's traveled the world. So he has a good perspective on what's important and what's beautiful and what's unique and rare and we need to save.
And you've been listening to my co-host, Russell Ziemba. You've been listening to Focus on Albany. And if you like this show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to iTunes for Focus on Albany. And if you have a comment about the show, go on Twitter, hashtag Focus on Albany, and share your thoughts. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, John, and have a good night.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Wow, I got on. I can't believe I did it.
Okay, come on outside. Let me turn down.